Hi, Will.
Hey, Joel. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you. Yourself?
Doing really well. Excited to get to have a conversation with the individual who gave me my first $500 I made working in technology.
Isn't that weird? I remember it because I was just starting too, and you helped me with this Django project. That was like my first application I ever wrote. And I distinctly remember you asking me for like $15 an hour, and I insisted on paying you more.
I think I delivered some sort of Moo Tools front end, which is the first time I've thought about Moo Tools in probably like, I don't know, 10 plus years. And I don't think it worked very well. So I think I kind of delivered that full $15 of value. I don't know if I got up to 50, but I certainly learned a lot kind of along the way.
I mean, I effectively assigned you with like rebuilding the Django admin panel as a UI front end. Like, it was really weird. Like, here's the funny thing, that software actually still lives. So let's sleep with that every night, the fact that software still lives. So it's good to finally talk to you. We worked together a long time ago, over a decade ago. We were both starting out, and then we've kind of both had our careers and come to where we are now. And what I'm really excited to talk to you today is about your book, An Elegant Puzzle, which I've read and quite enjoyed, which is about systems of engineering management. Can you tell me what systems of engineering management means?
I can certainly try. So first, getting to the title on the book took a lot of bad ideas.
I'm sure.
I think the first kind of 15 were pretty bad. And actually, we didn't get to the title until I wrote the introduction to the book. And it included the kind of term, you know, an elegant puzzle. And someone was like, your title is terrible. Why don't you use this? And I was like, that's definitely better than what I have right now. So then we use that. So that's kind of where the title came from, sort of. Fortunately, part of writing a book is people who are smarter than you give you feedback. So that definitely helped a lot in that case. But In terms of the idea about kind of the title, the subtitle, systems of engineering management, I've really found that a lot of management decisions in engineering in particular don't think about the long-term consequences and the long-term components that are interacting. And something that really changed my life for the better is when I read Donella Meadows' Thinking in Systems, a Primer. And it gave me this vocabulary and this set of tools to think about kind of long-term consequences. And sort of the stuff that I already had these intuitions about, I was able to actually talk about and codify in a really powerful way. And that's where a lot of my approach has come from, and that's where the title came from as well.
Going with that, what is a system?
That's a good question. So I think there's, you know, probably like 15 different definitions that we could go with, but maybe the two I would go with that I think are useful is first kind of an academic answer, which is I think systems are basically a reservoir of state and kind of flows in and out of those reservoirs to other reservoirs. So a good example kind of on the technology side might be you have a bunch of servers and then they're getting requests and they kind of come in at a certain rate and they get processed and completed at a certain rate. And if they come in too much faster than they go out, then you are run out of capacity to service them. That could be like one simple system. On the people side, though, one way to think about it could be your hiring funnel is a system. Your onboarding funnel is a system. Your kind of conversion funnel, if you think about kind of users purchasing, coming to your site, kind of considering purchasing and actually purchasing, these are all funnels where they have kind of people in different states that are transitioning across them in certain ways. And the powerful thing is when you start looking at across the system, it forces you to try to think about not just, I want to double sales and kind of have that target. It forces you to try to make a change upstream in the system and understand how that would get you to doubled sales. And that's a really powerful forcing function to actually understand the depth, the size of work you want versus just kind of focusing on the outcome that you'd be really excited about.
I think it's interesting because you talk about hiring as a system and onboarding as a system and sales as a system. And in fact, they're all kind of like actors in a larger system, right? Like if we make any changes to these, it kind of affects the others.
Every system, it turns out, is just like a kind of a box in a larger system. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the interesting problems is how do you model something useful when the reality is just extraordinarily complicated? To your point, our ability to hire in part depends on our ability to actually get people to buy our product because we have like more money. We have kind of a brand that people are excited about. People are passionate about the products. And so it does all connect, but I think if you look at the full complexity, it gets pretty overwhelming. And so trying to figure out how to simplify into something that is both useful, but also possible to reason about, I think, is one of kind of the special skills of systems thinking that you have to develop over kind of repeated failure over the years.
Systems thinking to me has been, I don't know, it's one of those things like when you get a little bit of it and you start to kind of buy into this concept of systems thinking, you start to see it everywhere, right? Like everything we do, everything, you know, everything on this planet, or even, you know, like our universe, right? Like to expand it to like the very far out there, like is part of this system, and there's actors and things change, and we can model and we can try to make predictions, but then, you know, like the kind of chaos, kind of everyday, you know, like individual actors making decisions that you cannot, you know, there's no predicting that. It's really interesting. But then at the same time, like to me, it's practically the only way I want to think anymore.
So I think prediction's hard. When I think about prediction, I think about what is the Isaac Asimov kind of foundation series, where they develop kind of a mathematical kind of foundation for prediction about the future. And I think I don't think systems thinking helps us predict super well, but I do think it helps us kind of make choices. And for me, the place where I first learned about systems thinking a very long time ago was really from Rachel Carson and Silent Spring, which is kind of a look at how kind of pollution in ecosystems kind of has surprisingly small amounts can kind of poison the entire ecosystem as like larger fish eat smaller fish, et cetera. And I think that was a thing that was, before she did all that research, was very hard to understand and seemed kind of impossible to predict. But then after doing that, it became like very easy to reason about. So I do think there's cases where these tools make it possible to kind of understand, and understanding can lead to some predictive properties anyway.
So I wanted to kind of rewind a little bit, because we jumped right into your book, and I want to talk about that more. But I'm curious, because this book is about management, and you are, and one could assume that you know something about management, so you have experience in this area. And I was wondering, I know you started out kind of as a front-end developer, and I'm wondering what's the path that you took to go from being an individual contributor into managing software and engineers?
So to your point, my first full-time technical work as an engineer was being a front-end developer at Yahoo. Worked on this, actually a product I have a lot of love for still, but it was Yahoo Build Your Own Search Service, Yahoo Boss. And it was a pretty cool way to expose Yahoo search indexes to kind of to anyone who wanted to build on top of it. We had an API you could use, et cetera. So I did that for about a year. And then as I got into my second year there, folks started kind of asking me to work on lots of other pieces of the system. So I ended up working on kind of a bit of everything on my second year on that project. Then, you know, Yahoo going through a kind of a weird set of times, a bunch of layoffs, kind of trying to understand its place in the industry. I went to Dig, and I think the day before I started at Dig, or the Friday before I started on a Monday, the CEO kind of left very suddenly. And my friend called me, he was like, hey, like, it's going to be fine. You know, the classic Silicon Valley like myth, which the worst thing that can possibly happen is your equity be worth like hundreds of thousands of dollars. But that's just the downside risk. It could be way bigger than that. And, you know, you're not very smart, you're younger, and you're like, this seems like a great opportunity. So you kind of jump in anyway. And it ended up really, I think maybe 3 to 4 months later, I was managing a team, not through any sort of intention to be managing a team, but just because there were a bunch of folks leaving the company. And some of the advice I give folks, which I think no one has ever appreciated this advice that I keep trying anyway, is that I really think at companies that are struggling, there's a lot of opportunity.
Yep.
And sometimes it's not easy opportunity, and it's not structured super well, or it's not like packaged up where you just get to have an easy entry into management. And so it takes a lot of privilege to have the opportunity to fail as badly as I think I did in my first management role there. But a year into my Dig experience, I was managing the entire engineering team, which was also much smaller than it was when I started. But still, I was the only engineering manager at the company. And that was how I started. And it was hugely informative. It was like really the foundation of a lot of what I've learned and my approach, which was there's not someone teaching you. There's not like an easy path. You just have to kind of go learn by trying, thinking, going back to the principles and trying to figure out how to make it all come together.
You have an appendix in your book that talks about all of the books that you've read. And I assume that probably started when you realized that you know, managing humans was going to be on your list of activities.
Yeah, I had no idea I was going to become a manager when I joined Dig. So interestingly, you know, I joined Dig. So that was my kind of third year in the industry. And I wasn't even a senior engineer. I was hired as just like a mid-level engineer. And so it was quite, I've actually never had the title of senior engineer. I kind of made this unintentional lateral transition at that point. And I didn't have the idea I was going to be one. And I had no like intention to be one. But once you are, I think something that I feel really strongly is this like obligation to the team. And you are really, you know, impacting folks' lives in a tremendous way. And to me, that's a pretty heavy responsibility. And so I wanted to try to educate myself. Although it took, I really feel only after 6 years of management, I started to have kind of the basics down. I think the first 5 or 6 years were fairly rocky for everyone involved. I appreciate the folks that have taught me so much, particularly the folks that taught me while letting me try to manage them along the way.
Yeah, being patient with you. They're being managed, but they're being patient with you as a manager and helping you to succeed, like a mutual kind of respect and ebb and flow, I assume.
I think one of the really interesting things is that when we go into school, there's kind of this like sense that authorities are these all-knowing kind of perfect figures that are responsible for everything. Mm-hmm. I think in a school, that's sort of true. It's a very controlled environment. But in work, your managers are often, you know, less experienced than you. They're often, you know, dealing with some really complicated stuff in their personal lives. They're often, you know, dealing with all these circumstances, like maybe their peers are struggling, or maybe their manager is having like a rough time for various reasons. So it's easy to kind of put all this responsibility onto them. But I think looking at them as people who are kind of going through their own like life and at their own kind of speed with their own circumstances has been, for me, really important. Early on, I had this kind of impossibly high bar for the managers that I worked with. And I think that was like pretty bad for both of us until I started to understand they were people too.
Right. You mentioned senior engineers in the title of senior engineer. And you know, I think about that term a lot. And because I mainly think about the inverse of it, where people were described as junior engineers. And it, you know, sometimes it feels maybe a little condescending. But what is, in your mind, how do you define a senior engineer?
So first, in terms of kind of junior, I've been trying to move to like early career as kind of a replacement, and that feels a little bit better. Not perfect, but I think more accurate.
Language is hard.
It's hard, but also like mobile, where it keeps kind of moving. And as you learn the right ways, they're wrong again, and you have to continue to stay humble enough to keep changing how you speak, even though it kind of is not the way you grew up or the way you relearned 5 years ago, or even the way you relearned last year, right? It's mm-hmm. constantly moving target, which is hard, but I think important to kind of come to terms with. I think what is a senior engineer, and what is a staff engineer, and what is a principal engineer, and what is a distinguished engineer? These are really, really challenging questions, right? For me, what a senior engineer is, one, a career level. This might be kind of, for most companies, the majority of folks will advance to this level, but might not advance beyond it. So something that you could develop mastery at for you know, decades in your career is one aspect of senior. And I think some companies use it in this sense and some companies don't. But to me, a senior engineer ought to be able to take sort of an arbitrarily confusing and poorly framed problem, frame it into something that's solvable and useful, and lead the execution against it of you know, like a modest sized team, maybe a team of like 8. Mm-hmm. So to me, if you can do all of those things, then I think you're like absolutely a senior engineer. And then sort of how many different types of problems should a senior engineer be able to solve to kind of fit that criteria? I don't actually have like a great rule of thumb for that. I think we want our senior engineers, certainly at Stripe, to be quite broad. But still, we have folks who are like extraordinarily strong front-end engineers, and we wouldn't ask them to work on a distributed infrastructure problem. But they're still like, you know, easily senior engineers in terms of their technical depth, their experience, and their ability to take these poorly framed problems and turn them into something useful.
I think another aspect to me of a senior engineer, and you know, it can relate directly to experience, sure. But then there's also this idea that it's somebody that it's a leadership role, and you're able to mentor and you're able to teach and help other people. Seems like that's probably an important part of at least some job descriptions that include senior in the title.
Mentorship, teaching, being a multiplier, making the team better than with you than without. you know, there was obviously kind of the Twitter outrage about this 10x engineer.
Again, it's a recycled outrage, but yeah.
Well,
recently
you gotta keep a, it's like fashion every 7 years. It's going to be for you.
The bell bottoms of Twitter outrage.
Yeah. That's the bell bottoms of Twitter outrage. Love it. So I think that there is that engineer is a real person, that engineer who kind of comes in, kind of sucks up the oxygen where folks around them become less effective, but they become extremely effective. We've probably all worked with someone, not even just engineers, like you see this person kind of in any career. So I think there is that person who is effective in part by making others less effective. And I think we have to be careful of that person and not kind of think of them as pure individual, quote unquote, excellence in that way as kind of senior, but instead, to your point, kind of making the overall sum of the system, the team, larger.
I think there's a section title in your book that is Kill the Hero Programmer, which is not literal. And I think that kind of speaks to this point. And I was wondering, what do you mean when you say, you know, we need to kill the hero programmer?
So this is the oldest piece in my book. I first wrote that 10 years ago. I think if I was writing that today, I probably would not have used the term kill. I think I would have tried to find a less stark way to kind of frame the point.
Yeah.
But the idea is that I think you find these really well-meaning folks who have sort of been captured by their company or their organization or their process in a way where they have to keep working harder and harder to kind of sustain basic function. And they don't have enough time to think and to solve kind of the fundamental issue, which is causing them to have to work harder and harder, which is creating them as a kind of single point of execution, a single point of failure. And they get put in this really terrible spot where their lives are basically consumed by their work. But they also get this like outpouring of credit and kind of love from the company, or at least kind of often the leadership, which views them as kind of this essential individual. And so I've been in a lot of situations, and I think, you know, have personally been in that situation myself as the hero, where you feel like you're carrying it, or kind of your Sisyphus, or your maybe Atlas is a better phrase, you know, the world on your shoulders. And you think you're doing a great thing, and then you're actually breaking the system around you. And so the idea behind the article is, how do we help folks who are doing this amazing work, who are trying so hard to help the company or the team or the environment, but are actually undermining the system and themselves, realize that? And how do we avoid putting them in that situation and kind of keeping them there?
It kind of relates to the idea of the 10x engineer, in that we've taken this hero and we've put them on a pedestal, but then we're actually requiring them to like carry this weight when in fact, and even if they are contributing at that level, it's not healthy, and it's definitely not healthy over long term, and it might not even be where they want to be, you know, in terms of their career, just, you know, the lifestyle that comes along with that.
I look at the difference between the 10x engineer and the hero is that the 10x engineer, I think, sometimes they have this identity as the person who is going to do it all. Or I think the hero tends to be more of kind of an accident where they get kind of pulled into the role. But I think you're right that the overlap here is pretty strong.
Yeah, where the hero is somebody, you know, that is maybe identified as a quote 10x engineer and given the responsibility as such, but, you know, didn't really ask for it.
And the hero and the 10x engineer as well are kind of this precursor to burnout culture, which is kind of the obvious consequence.
Yes.
But I think one of the downsides of folks kind of changing jobs every couple of years is that you can often kind of hide the signs of burnout for 2 years, and then folks don't understand kind of the consequences long term when people disappear. They're like, oh, they're just switching jobs. But in reality, what you've done is like basically crush this person's spirit for the moment, and they're off like recuperating somewhere in private.
Yeah, squeeze the joy out of the whole thing, because it's great, and this job can be amazing, and solving puzzles constantly is a really wonderful privilege that we get to experience. But then, you know, you can take that too far, and burnout's real.
And to your point, I think what you just described there about kind of the job being amazing is one of the interesting challenges here, where, you know, by and large, folks working in software, and particularly folks working in Silicon Valley in software or at a successful company like yours, are truly some of the most privileged people in America, one of the most privileged countries in the world. And yet, they still do have real challenges here created by burnout, and figuring out how to have that conversation in a way where we can like acknowledge that, while also acknowledging the privilege that we're kind of standing upon, is, I think, always like a difficult line to navigate.
I think this really leads to a question I had about the description that you put forth of management as an ethical and or moral profession. And I was wondering if you could expand on that and maybe tell me why you consider management to be an ethical, moral profession.
To me, what it means for a profession to be ethical is that your decisions matter, and they matter in a very real way. For example, when you decide who to promote, I think there's a couple of different ways you could think about that. One way, which is very pragmatic, is that you promote people based on who you think will leave if they don't get promoted. And that is kind of optimizing for retention is, I guess, one kind of way you might describe that. But then the consequence is that you have the folks who are kind of doing the work you want, the folks who are not demanding are effectively getting punished by not getting promoted. And you kind of get into the spot where the people who are doing what you ask them to do are disproportionately disadvantaged. And you've created a system where kind of the suckers lose. And the suckers here are kind of people like me or people like you or people who have this strong sense of duty to their work. And so when I think of management as an ethical profession, I think about it in terms of how do we take accountability for the systems and the behaviors that we put out into the world and make sure that we're creating the kind of justice in the outcomes of our work and not just results. I think results come in line with justice in a lot of companies, but I think there's ways to get kind of results without justice and ways to get justice without results. And so the difficult part of management is finding the way to get both. And that to me is kind of where kind of the elegant puzzle component of management really comes into play, is trying to find a way to get both justice and results on your teams and in your company.
You know, as a manager or even as an independent contributor, like incentives play a part in all of this, right? Like we have incentives to keep people in particular positions or retention. There's incentives to take somebody that cares and, you know, kind of leverage that caring to, you know, expand their position to meet our business goals and that sort of thing. And I'm wondering, you know, how do we manage that? How do we manage incentives and put in the right incentives as managers or, you know, people that are contributing to a project?
Part of incentives is that there is real scarcity. And so you can't just pay everyone as much as they want without a certain consequence to your budget. You don't have enough roles for kind of everyone that wants to have larger roles. This is most true for kind of management roles where there's certain like properties that are like hard to fake. For example, I want to get experience managing managers. There's only so many manager roles that manage managers, mm-hmm. Where you can talk about impact in different ways to kind of create kind of this ongoing kind of larger and larger roles, larger and larger impact. But at a certain point, there's just constraints that are actually limited. And so how do you assign those is to me like a big part of that. I think part of this is you have to let people know honestly and openly about like the opportunities that there are, and the opportunities have to be aligned with what the company needs. And sometimes I think that means folks won't be able to stay with you at your company, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Where this gets tricky, though, is like the financial incentives. And so I think a lot of companies kind of with these kind of stock options and kind of the short exercise periods, you can get into like pretty perverse scenarios where folks, you know, can't get the opportunity they want, but they're still doing work of value to the company. And they personally feel like they can't leave because the financial loss, often just perceived financial loss, is too high. And I think that's in particular where a lot of companies, I think, optimize their financial compensation around not losing folks. Like, how do we retain folks? But they don't necessarily optimize it for folks being impactful and kind of engaged. I think Netflix is a good example of the latter, where they've not gone towards kind of the option model, but instead focus on kind of short-term cash comp and rewarding folks while they're there, but also in a way where it's cheap for folks to leave if it's not working out for them.
Yeah, they'll cut ties quick. And it goes either way. Like you can leave, we'll cut you, but we'll also, while you're here, you're going to get paid and treated very well.
Although something really interesting about the Netflix model that I didn't really understand is part of the reason it works and part of the reason that their engineers are very productive is they really don't spend much time on mentorship, on training, by virtue of only hiring kind of later career folks into the company. And there are certain elements of that that I think work because of the trade-offs they've made, but they're pretty extreme trade-offs that I think not most folks are interested in making.
something you discuss, and this is related to company culture, kind of speaking of that, is the idea of opportunity and mentorship, or membership, excuse me. And this is, I think, the idea of building an inclusive organization where everybody gets opportunity and membership. And I'm wondering, what are your kind of favorite ways to build, you know, a more inclusive workplace with both opportunity and membership for people that work there?
When you start thinking about inclusion and diversity, I think where a lot of folks start is this idea, how do we hire more folks from underrepresented minorities and more women into the company? Mm-hmm. And then you often kind of get stuck on this, if we could just increase top of funnel. And I think there's a lot of ways to increase top of funnel. Cold sourcing is the most effective one that I've personally found. But events, you know, lots of ways to do it. But I think this is taking the easy way out because you're looking at these kind of short-term measurables. And you do need to do that. Like, this is critical work, but it's only one piece of it. And ultimately, the success in terms of thinking about an inclusive organization is that folks from any background can come and can be continue to get promoted and rewarded for the work and to feel like they belong to the environment at the same time. So I've started thinking about inclusion in terms of, as you described, kind of access to opportunity and then access to membership. And so for access to opportunity, this has been the one that I spent the most time on over the last 2 years, and I've learned, I think, a fair amount about. One anti-pattern you'll see at some companies is that every time there's a critical initiative, like the same two or three people get pulled into it. Mm-hmm. It's always Sarah, it's always like Jeremy or something, and it's always the same person getting pulled in. And people are like, I want to do that, but I can't get access to it. And then this is kind of the hero pattern exposing as an inequality across the company for other folks, because most people aren't the hero. So how do you create the possibility for other folks to participate, but in a way that's also safe, where you don't have kind of, you do have to get the work done. It's not okay for just kind of anyone who wants to do it to get these critical projects. You need someone who you have confidence can do it. And so we've worked on building this kind of selection process, where we kind of send out publicly, letting people apply. We give them time to apply so they can talk to their manager, talk to their peers and outside of the company to kind of get a sense about whether this is the right time for them. We explain the level of commitment. And then we ask them to kind of privately apply to say me or whoever's running the process. And then we have a selection criteria to pick kind of the folks. And we give feedback to each person who applies and double check, double confirm with the person who we choose that they're willing to take on the project, say like an architecture group or something, leading an architecture group, something like that. And this has been really powerful because all of a sudden people are aware of these projects. I think they're aware of the downsides of the projects, where I think when you only see kind of the glamour, you don't see the kind of the risk, the level of effort, the amount of time, the tight timelines or whatnot. And also it allows us to instrument and measure kind of the cardinality of folks getting these projects and actually understand, is this a problem or not? And so when we started one of our kind of senior engineer leadership groups, one of their goals, one of the metrics they measured themselves against was increasing the number of distinct people leading important projects. And that goal in measuring it was only possible because of this kind of selection process we put together. So I think that's been really powerful. It didn't work super well initially. We've had to iterate on it a couple times. For example, I thought people would just apply, but I've learned you really have to go out and privately nudge everyone you want to apply. If you don't personally invite someone to apply, they probably won't. It has been different people have different risk tolerances, right? And you have to be thoughtful about that and make sure you encourage folks who might have a higher risk for kind of a certain type of project to take it on.
I would assume if you don't do the nudging, then you get the kind of the usual suspects, so to speak.
It is not that effective if you don't do the nudging. And that's, mm-hmm. It's also time consuming. So if you don't do it, if you don't do the nudging, it's both slower and doesn't actually work. So it's pretty easy to decide it's a terrible
it's
process
just broken.
At all. Yeah. Throw it away.
Hiring is hard in general. And I think, you know, like the technical interview that comes up, you know, so much like in terms of people just hating it. And I think mostly they're kind of railing on the, you know, the idea of, you know, the whiteboard interview or these kind of, you know, high pressure quiz like game show style interview processes, which still exist and are hopefully kind of moving away from that. Is it similar to, you know, like what you're talking about in terms of opportunity? Is it, you know, like internally for projects, but then externally when we're hiring? Because hiring is hard on both sides. It's hard for candidates. It's hard for firms and organizations to do it. How are you working on making that process better?
I agree with you. I think hiring is hard on kind of all dimensions. And I was talking to someone recently. They were, how do I find the company I want to join? And part of the conversation we had that I thought was quite interesting is that if you look at how often women or underrepresented minorities kind of vet companies they're applying to versus how kind of white men often vet companies, on one hand, you see a huge amount of back channel exploration, trying to understand. And then on the other, you often like see effectively no kind of research and attempting to understand. And I think it's interesting how kind of the security and privilege of kind of one of those situations makes it possible to kind of like not vet the company that you're applying to much, because you're confident that it'll probably work out. And if it doesn't, you can, you know, just switch to another. And seeing how different those kind of approaches are has been really informative to me, as well as I've gotten further into my management career and understanding how hiring impacts different communities so differently. In terms of like how we kind of work on hiring, to me, the most important thing for any endeavor is having feedback loops to make sure you're getting better. For example, very early on, you know, like 5-6 years ago, our interviews didn't have rubrics. And as we kind of debriefed on trying to understand whether the interviews had gone well or not, getting aligned was extremely hard. And from that process, we realized, hey, we need rubrics for every single interview. They should be numerical. They should have like 4 or 5 points with clear criteria that are objective. And we can use those to start having like a shared vocabulary about the performance in each of these interviews. And then we iterated on each of the rubrics over time to kind of like narrow in and to get more and more consistent. And then another one is like, you can still have people who are inconsistent across interviewers. So mm-hmm. then we rolled out this candidate review system where we have folks who review all the feedback and look for inconsistencies. And then we can go coach folks who are kind of out of alignment with the rubric. And we can also see places where the rubrics just aren't working well for us. So layering in these feedback mechanisms where you have a learning process that can keep getting better has been the most important system. In terms of kind of the access to opportunity component of it, I think rubrics are quite important. I think having mechanisms where you can see where the rubrics are not getting applied consistently is quite important. And then also just whenever folks decline, we try to do a decline, a post-decline call with them and learn what they decided turned them to pick a different company to go with. Although that's obviously the power dynamics in that situation are pretty weird, where folks often just don't give you the full perspective on why they might not choose to work at a given company.
Can you give me an example of a rubric for myself? I'm just curious what would be a simple rubric that you would use in this sort of process?
So we redid our manager of manager interview loop. Mm-hmm. Maybe 6 or 7, maybe 9 months ago. Who knows? Time flies. Not good with dates. And so we were thinking about how do we think about, in particular, folks who have dealt with kind of rapidly growing organizations. And so a rubric here might be, on one hand, have never dealt with a team that shrunk or grew, have only dealt with small static size teams. And that might be like a 1. And then a 4 might be has dealt with a team that has grown rapidly, at least, you know, 50% year over year, and they can speak to the metrics showing how they did that in a healthy, sustainable way without burning out the team. And that could be the top of the line. And they'd have kind of gradients in between with like specific accomplishments that they've made or approaches that they demonstrated. For example, anyone with money can grow a team really quickly.
Yeah.
So that's not like a 4. It's just like, you know, hired at great abandon with no foresight is like not the goal, but instead being able to talk to the counter pressures where they part of our rubrics, in fact, like an example of not hiring as fast as someone wanted them to, and instead being able to explain how they kind of paced the hiring in a thoughtful, effective way.
Yeah. I mean, mass hiring can be, that just gives me that runs cold shivers down my spine, actually, just even thinking about it. I need like low scale, like small teams. That's where I'm best at. I've never had to experience the hyper growth of a successful startup. or I guess a potentially successful startup in some cases.
Well, I mean, it seems like you're doing something right. It seems, I guess maybe you don't think of yourself as a startup, which I think is kind of a particular term that means a lot of things to a lot of people, but clearly you've been able to scale the business really well over time without hiring a ton of folks to do it, which to me seems like even more.
Yeah, we're totally not growth oriented. We're and oblique in a lot of our approaches, just by nature, kind of a slow simmer is how we're approaching it. And it's been interesting, but like you said, when you were thrown into management, I kind of had the same experience, right? Like I don't know how to run a business or manage humans and had to learn on the job, and it's, you know, ups and downs, but overall it's working out pretty well. I want to know about instrumentation of a hiring funnel, because this is something that I hadn't, this is the first time I'd heard of this idea. Like I've heard of instrumentation and software where we're, you know, like sending data so we can analyze performance, and I assume it's similar, but how do you instrument your hiring funnel so that you get, you know, valuable metrics back that you can actually use to improve that process?
So there's a category of software called like application tracking systems, like ATS, and Greenhouse mm-hmm. is one, Lever is another. Those are the two really big ones. And I think one of the upsides of these is they support kind of easy automation. But the other upside, which I think is even larger, is they actually set up workflows where you can instrument kind of what's happening along the way, how many people are sourced, how many people are referrals, how many people passed the phone screen, filled the phone screen. And you have the whole conversion funnel all the way through. And then I think that gets you 80% of the way there. I think these ATSs try to keep the data in, which can be a little bit tricky to actually get like good data out of it. But you can definitely, and things like GDPR, for example, have complicated some of the things you're able to do with your data. But in general, that's 80 or 90%. It's not the entirety of it. And that's where you need a system on the other side. Maybe it's your learning management system, your LMS, or maybe it's your Workday setup, or maybe it's a spreadsheet, you know, maybe it's anything, but some system where you don't just end the kind of the metrics at hire. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to first, there's kind of like, you know, looking at candidate success. I find this like a little bit hard to get enough data for most companies. They can actually say, like, oh, this person is a strong performer and there's enough of them. You can reach significance to say that this interview loop is or is not effective or something. You can eventually do that at a certain scale, but most companies aren't that size. But you can instead start instrumenting, like, how long did it take them to get to their third pull request with more than 15 lines of code changed or something, like some sort of metric around kind of being spun up. And I think that's really powerful because it helps you understand like your hiring rate in large part depends on your ability to ramp people up effectively. If you're able to ramp people up quickly, then those people can quickly start training other people. And if not, you can't. So I really think the hiring funnel at every company should at minimum track through kind of being ramped up to be effective.
Like as a systems and data modeling nerd, Stripe must be just an amazing like test bed for all this sort of information and data and process and just kind of learning and growing in that way, I would think.
Yeah, any fast-growing company, but particularly it's a lot easier when you're fast-growing on the way up. I think when I joined Dig, it was fast-growing on the way down, and that was less kind of instructive in this regard. Although also interesting to see how systems like fail to kind of scale down. But really any fast-growing company, I think, is the best place in the world to learn quickly about systems and how they work in reality and not kind of just in principle.
My outside observation is that it wouldn't be just, you know, like any, and that Stripe is kind of special in several different ways. And like, the, I don't know, like I'm looking at your book, right? And I'm looking at what this company is doing, and I'm so totally like floored because this doesn't make sense, right? Like the Stripe Press doesn't. I think it's like an oblique strategy, right? It doesn't really make a lot of sense, but it's amazing. Like your book is amazing. The other, you know, Tyler Cohen's book is amazing. And like, I just look at this company from the outside and then, you know, I've read like the hiring is done and they're cohorts and they start every couple of weeks and they're significant, right? Like non-trivial amounts of people being hired to like feed this global engine of this company that like changed my life for one, but I don't know. It's interesting. That's my Stripe fanboy. Spiel a little bit, but
yeah, yeah. There's probably like 50 people joining every 2 weeks or something. That's that might even be low. It's humbling to see just how many folks are kind of joining us at this point. It's really shocking considering where we were when I joined not that long ago.
Yeah, It's cool. I'm curious about this idea of building a community of learning, both inside of the workplace and then outside of the workplace, and what that means and how, you know, we, you know, as participants can help facilitate that sort of thing.
So first, thinking about the inside versus outside of workplace kind of trade-off, I think one of the interesting things about becoming more senior in a large company is that you're not really allowed to express the negative kind of feelings you have. You really have to find a way to contain those. Like it's not very inspiring for you to be kind of complaining in front of your team a lot. You have to kind of find the most positive version of the truth that is still the truth and really try to stick to that. And so I think that's, to me, why as you get more senior, having folks outside of the company is so incredibly helpful, where you are able to be, you know, hey, we're doing this. This doesn't seem right. Like, what do you think? And then people are like, nope, that's how it works everywhere. You're just got to get over it. Or you're like, nope, that one actually is pretty weird. That you should probably push back on more than you are. And just this kind of grounding sounding board where you can go and get feedback from folks that you're not getting kind of the day-to-day feedback from. So just like a different ear with different kind of perspective for you. I found that incredibly helpful. And just, this is something for myself I've worked pretty hard to cultivate over the last couple of years. I realized at one point I didn't have much of a support network in this regard of peers who are just doing similar work. So I've been reaching out pretty intentionally to like one or two a quarter over the last couple of years, just trying to find and develop these relationships so that I have them when I need advice, need perspective. And if there was only one piece of advice I could give myself like 10 years ago, it would have been to start doing this then, not trying to pick it up now. It is easier when you've been in the industry longer, you know more folks to kind of like introduce you to people. But I really think if you get good at the kind of cold email, of like asking one really short, crisp question, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. You can kind of meet anyone. It's a superpower to write an email that people actually respond to. But it's like one you can learn pretty easily if you put a lot of effort into it. But so that's kind of the external component. Internally, I think, you know, so many companies are so focused on getting done what they need to today, this week, this quarter, that they kind of don't invest into this community and this idea of like long-term learning. And to me, that's what really makes kind of a company long-term sustainable for you, is that you are doing and learning new things kind of every 18, every 24 months, where you don't have to switch companies or even necessarily switch like roles, because what you're able to learn continues to grow with you and around you. And so to me, these kind of manager meeting where we meet every 2 weeks to kind of discuss like an interesting topic. We can have like offsites. We're picking up we have a couple of book reading groups already, and we're kind of picking up another one. There's like all these different ways, like paper reading groups where you kind of talk about like interesting architecture papers or really anything. And it doesn't have to be technical. It can be like management oriented. It can be about kind of the industry that your company's in. Just getting folks to kind of break out of the day-to-day like mastery of what they're good at and get back into this learning mindset of engaging with something they aren't super familiar with.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. It's important, and just important like as a human to keep learning and growing and pushing the boundaries as well.
Something I've been thinking about a lot for the last year is that I think in Silicon Valley in particular, but kind of in tech in general, you know, we talked about senior engineers before, part of the getting the senior title often 4 or 5 years into your career. So I think a lot of folks kind of think they're done after 4 years, but really it's just the beginning. There's like so much more to learn about so many things that I think are really gratifying to keep spending time engaging with and not calcifying at that point.
Yeah, and it's amazing. I think, I don't know, like I'm always amazed by the level of information and just cool stuff there is to learn and discover.
It's endless.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to chat with me. It was great. Thank you very much.
Likewise. It was a real pleasure. Hope to do it again sometime soon.
Cheers.